Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 350, I chat with video guru Joe Kane about his recent trip to CinemaCon 2017 and the future of cinema. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded April 20th, 2017. Episode 350, The Future of Cinema. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of avsforum.com. This week's guest geek is Joe Kane, video guru and a frequent guest on Home Theater Geeks. Hey, Joe, welcome back.
Good afternoon. It's great to be here.
Always glad to have you here. Those of you who are watching live at live.twit.tv can log into the chat room there or at irc.twit.tv, and you can post questions as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. Always helps if you put my screen name in the message, which is my name, Scott Wilkinson, no dots or dashes, because then it shows up in a different color on my screen and I more easily see it. So what I want to talk today about is CinemaCon, which is an annual convention in Las Vegas for theater, I guess, commercial cinema exhibitors, owners, primarily. Isn't that the audience, Joe?
It's put together by the National Association of Theater Owners. I usually spell that out rather than saying NATO because not very many people would understand.
Yes.
This is not a European North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Yeah. It deals with all aspects of theatrical presentation. It's everything from movie stars being at the convention promoting their latest movie to concessions, what goes on, then things that a theater owner can sell in the concession stands. And of course, it feeds the important part of image quality and projectors and screens and audio systems and so it's everything to do with theatrical presentations.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've heard as well as I have, I'm sure, that a lot of home theater owners say, you know what? I've got a better experience here at home than I do in the cinema, than I can get by going out to the cinema. Plus, I don't have to deal with lines and crowds and sticky floors and people kicking my seat. Well, maybe if you've got kids at home, they might be kicking your seat. But in any event, what is your take on that in terms of relative quality of presentation in the commercial cinema versus in a good home cinema?
Well, in oral and visual quality for the specifications that home delivery provides, which are slightly different from what a digital cinema is all about in the theater, I certainly feel that there is an opportunity for the home viewer to get a really good picture and something that would be difficult to replicate in the majority of theaters. That said, this conference and everything about the discussions at this conference was how do we get people out of their house and into the theaters? So the conference was all about the opposite of what you're talking about, you know, where people think that they can get a much better experience at home. Theater owners are being encouraged to do something that will get you out of the house anyway.
Even with a good home theater, they want to offer you something you can't get at home, I suspect.
Yes, that's a really big part of what this conference was about, at least from my point of view. It was what can the theater owner provide to the audience that they can't get at home that will be considered attractive enough so that they'll show up at the theater? And I actually found a lot of the things that were being presented there to be interesting. And oh my gosh, they really are looking at their audience and finding things that could potentially make it a social occasion where you would go to the theater to meet your friends, and you would even do things in the lobby that would be socially oriented, something that we can discuss in detail in a minute. But they're doing things to get you to come to the theater and treat the theater as a social gathering point.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I even recently, I noticed I go out to the movies pretty regularly, mostly to Dolby Cinemas to see movies that have been graded in high dynamic range. And recently I've begun to see a lot of little trailers, not trailers exactly, but just little squibs on the screen with the star of the movie I'm about to see saying, "Thank you for coming out to the movies," which means that they really do want to attract people out. And not a lot of people do. For example, Emily the Strange says, besides being actually in the theater and seeing the movie, I loathe the movie going experience. I don't think she's alone on that either.
Well, one of the things you talked about, the movie stars doing something to encourage you to come. One of the things that surprised me was the lobby experience, that they now have backlit posters for the particular movie, and they have phone apps so that you can go in and you can stand in front of the poster, and there's lighting coming down on you. And then you go to your phone app and you pick the star of the movie that you would like to have standing next to you with the movie poster in the background.
Really?
And yes. And the stars or characters are lit in a very similar way, so that as you are virtually standing next to them, they look lit as you are lit. And what? So you choose who you want to be standing next to you, and then you get somebody with an iPhone to take the picture, and what the picture shows is you with the character in the movie.
Wow.
With the movie poster behind. And I looked at this and said, well, it at least they're doing it in a way that it is more difficult to tell that the star wasn't actually there.
And it's kind of the lighting, modern – because the lighting was the same.
Good. The lighting is good. The resolution appeared to be quite similar. And it would be harder to tell that the person wasn't actually there. And I have no idea how much that's actually going to attract real people to come into a theater. But mm-hmm. I liked the look of the application.
You know, it kind of reminds me of a couple things. One is the paper, the cardboard, what are called standees. Right, you could have a life-size cardboard cutout of some star standing next to you, and people have been taking pictures of that with themselves for a long time. This is kind of the augmented reality version of that, which is pretty cool.
Right, and I at least found that application quite interesting in theaters. I attended the convention partially to see what's going on and display technology. And I know we're going to talk about that, but
yeah, that's the main focus here. But I just, wanted to start with, theatrical.
I learned a lot about what is expected of theater owners to get people to come into the theater and see the movie in the theater, as opposed to, seeing it in their own home theater, which is usually what I do.
Terry Kay is asking, and I don't know if you know the answer to this or if you heard it at the show, is theater attendance down?
That certainly wasn't what was conveyed. I don't remember the numbers, but they were talking about the fact that with blockbuster movies, that this past year has been one of the best years that theaters have experienced. And of course, they were saying that the things that theater owners are doing to augment the reality of your being in the theater. I like the augmented reality phrase. because they are creating an augmented reality. One of the things that struck me in particular that I thought was of interest to me as a traveler, of course, for whatever it's worth, I do travel international first class quite often. Mm-hmm. And
You got enough miles to be able to upgrade easily, I'm sure.
Yeah. It's the way it goes. But anyway, what do you do when you're on an international first class flight? You watch movies. And mm-hmm. of course, what also happens during an international first class flight is there's a reasonably good meal. I mean, whatever you think of airplane food, usually international first class is the best.
Pretty darn whatever. Good. Yeah. Right.
It's the best of whatever they're going to do.
Right.
And so it's interesting to me sitting on an airplane, watching movies on the tiny little screen and, you know, having reasonably good noise canceling headphones, mine, mm-hmm. Not theirs, but.
Right. Me too.
And having a meal served and whatever. Well, that experience is now something you can enjoy in the movie theater, that among the things that were shown were international first class style of seats that were available for the theaters. And of interest to me was that some of these seats had motion control. And of course, the motion would be associated with the film. But all I could think of is that it related to me the experience of a bumpy ride, you know, where it gets so bumpy where you have to lift your glass up off the table because you're afraid that it's going to spill. Mm-hmm. And the idea that these seats would be providing motion, it's almost as if they could be advertising your international first class flight without ever leaving your hometown. In other words, if you want to experience what it's like to be on an international first class flight for a much lower price, you mm-hmm. could come to your local theater and you could be watching the movie that you might be watching on your flight, and you could be sitting in a first class seat and you could get first class food service. Mm-hmm. I happened to talk to a person in the industry who was there who had experienced this in a Los Angeles-based theater. And he told me that his major objection to the way it was being implemented was that the food service was occurring during the movie and that there were wait staff. I don't want to call them flight attendants, but you know,
right.
Wait staff coming into your table during the movie.
Yeah, see, I don't understand this.
Drinks and changing the courses and
yeah. I mean, we've had meals served at your seat during movies in some very high end theaters for a while now, and I never understood that. Why would you tolerate having the waiter or the usher or whoever it is bringing your drinks and your food and stuff in the middle of the movie? That doesn't make any sense to me. I would not enjoy that.
Actually, it reminds me of my own flights where I have to hit the pause button anytime a flight attendant comes with more water, more wine, more, you know, a change of courses and whatever. I'm always at my pause button, pausing the movie so that I can deal with whatever interruption is occurring and then go back to the movie. And of course, you couldn't do that in a theater.
Couldn't do that in a theater. Yeah.
So,
I mean, for international first class seating is pretty nice. We also have Dolby Cinemas now with, and I think other auditoria are now installing reclining leather seats, power recliners and stuff. So things are getting pretty comfy in the theater, which is very nice. But you're right. You can't pause it. You can't pause it if you like have to go to the bathroom or you change your, you know, you got the waiter coming in with a new drink or something. Right. I'm not sure how well that's going to work ultimately.
Well, and that's part of what caught my attention. It was one of the things that I felt that I saw in the example that was at the show. But nonetheless, I still found it entertaining that somebody was promoting putting first international first class seating in a theater, and effectively saying, gee, you could have experience of international first class for a couple of hours coming to a theater. Don't know how interesting that would be to people. It would almost seem that it would be more interesting to airlines, in that they would be promoting to a much larger audience what you're missing if you're not booking first class.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Another thing that you mentioned, we talked about a little bit offline before the show, in terms of trying to attract people in, is something from Barco called Barco Escape. And yes. I believe you saw that at CinemaCon. I've seen it demonstrated. I tried to go actually see a movie in it. There's one theater, at least one theater here in L.A., maybe two now, that have this. But the time I went, it wasn't working. So I didn't get to see it. Yeah. They had some demos there, didn't they, of it this time around?
Oh, yes. I think you have an image of the screen configuration.
I do. Let's take a look at that. Barco Escape.
I think that would be a great thing to be to put up on screen while we talk about it. Yep. Yes. Yeah. Here we go with the Escape experience. And this is a reminder of Cinerama. Except for this is three flat screens. It is three projectors, and Barco is certainly partnering with productions that have wide vistas in them to actually produce for this format, so that you will actually take three cameras out and you will you will shoot a super widescreen image that can be divided up among the three images. Mm-hmm. So this is essentially what we saw. The interesting part is that, as I mentioned to you in the demonstration, the theater seating was raked at such a steep level so that when you were in any given seat, you did not see the person in front of you when they were completely below you when you were looking at the screen. Right. I'm not confident that that kind of a rake exists in theaters. It may, and I just don't know it.
Well, but Dolby Cinemas have a pretty strong rake, as you call it, or what's called stadium seating. I have no trouble in a Dolby Cinema looking at, you know, sitting in a row and seeing the screen, not seeing the person in front of me. That's definitely an improvement, in my opinion. What strikes me as difficult about this Barco Escape is that you'd better be pretty far forward into that U shape, if you will, in order for it to be effective. Am I right about that?
Well, certainly from my point of view, that you don't want to be too far back, but I would have to say the same as same could be said for Cinerama. I've been privileged here in Los Angeles to be able to see Cinerama a number of times. That every once in a while there are festivals, and as much as I've seen it before, I still try to go again. And there is reserve seating there, and I always try to get seats that will at least put me far enough forward so peripherally I feel like parts of the image are out there. And I also like being seated in the center, which is quite difficult. Even if you look at the seating that's in this illustration, it you can still see that there's an advantage to being dead center as opposed to being on the left or right.
No kidding. Kind of reminds me of curved screen TVs. Yes. If you're dead center, then you're great. But if you're off center, not so good.
Yeah. Don't get me started.
All right, we're talking about commercial cinema today, but
yes, but
it's a similar problem.
Yes. One of the things I did find in the demonstration that was presented is the contrast ratio on this image wasn't quite as good as the contrast ratio on a single screen. Mm. And I certainly attributed that to bounce of light from the side screens. Now, they're pointed out a little bit, but that doesn't prevent contamination from the corners. As an example, that corner spot on the left or right from the front screen to the two side screens, it still doesn't prevent them from having some reflectivity into the two side screens. I was not as impressed with the contrast ratio as I have been in single presentations. So, and I don't know how much that had to do with the setup that was in Las Vegas, but I did find it interesting to see it for the first time and understand the concept and what they're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. When I saw it at, I saw a demo at NAB a year and a half ago, 2 years ago now. NAB's coming up next week. They gave us some specs, and one of the specs was that on the front screen, the main screen, you would be looking at a 4K image, but on the side screens, it was 1080p.
It's 2K.
2K. Yeah, call it 2K. Yeah. And the reason they said was that your peripheral vision isn't as resolute, shall we say. And really, that stuff on the side is meant to be in your peripheral vision. And so they didn't think they needed to have as much resolution on the sides as they do on the front. It also requires, by the way, I should make sure everybody understands, requires three projectors, one for the main screen and one for each of the side screens. And so there's one thing, different in resolution between them. And so I don't know. I've never seen an actual movie in this format. I'm still hoping to at some point, but it's kind of interesting and not something you can get at home, that's for sure.
Well, but as far as the resolution is concerned, people have heard my discussion from the original days of the Digital Cinema Initiatives, where they actually had their own theater on in Hollywood, and they did tests between 4K projectors and 2K projectors, and what we found is that on perforated screens, there wasn't much difference. When you put up a solid screen, there was a noticeable difference between the two resolutions. Mm. So interestingly enough, obviously the front screen is further away from you than the side screens. Mm-hmm. So the fact that it is further away from you, a 4K resolution isn't going to make that much difference because you're going to be far enough back from it. Mm.
Good point.
You're not going to see. I would have guessed the two 2K projectors on either side were more of an economic thing, you know, for whatever 2K.
Oh, that's a good 4K, point.
Mm-hmm. For whatever 2K versus 4K costs, I would have guessed that it might have been done for an economic reason, and then somebody had to justify it.
So, of course, they said, oh, you know what? You can't see as much resolution in your peripheral vision, so we don't even need 4K there. We can save money, but we can justify it. That's good. Uh-huh.
And, of course, what's on the periphery is closer to you than what's up front. So one could argue in the opposite direction of that. But it is what it is, whatever they're promoting. And so I found that part of what was going on at the show interesting. Both Barco and Christie showed their high contrast 3 laser projector or 6 laser projectors, depending on the configuration. And I did find a huge advantage in the higher contrast. I have my own questions about the higher brightness, and we can get into that in HDR discussions. But I'm not as enthusiastic about the higher brightness the way it's currently being presented as a number of people are in the industry. So I'm not coming down on a good side of that.
So you don't think that the increased brightness of Dolby Cinema, for example, or IMAX laser is as important or impactful as many people say?
I certainly know what they're going for. And if I may, let me explain the position I'm taking.
Please, please.
Way back in the 1970s when I worked for Eastman Kodak, we did a lot of human factors research. Mm-hmm. And we found, and I'm going to use Foote Lamberts because that's what we used in the 70s.
Sure. But it's kind of old now, but it's still cool.
Because I haven't translated everything to NITS yet.
Right.
But we looked at images between 14 and 16 Foote Lamberts and found that when people were watching program content that was going from light to dark and whatever, that there was no real fatigue factor up to about 16 Foote Lamberts. And we found that anything over 16 Foote Lamberts and the contrast range of going from a dark image to a bright image introduced fatigue in the viewer. Now, I've talked to a lot of people who are looking at the 100 nit pictures, which are, about
30 Foote Lamberts.
Yeah, about 30 Foote Lamberts. Yeah, thank you. I've talked to people who are looking at the 100 nit pictures and say, yeah, after a two-hour movie that they didn't notice. And it was funny because the first time I went in, the first thing I noticed is, gee, that's a really bright image. And I'm going to have difficulty looking at that. But I'm conscious of those kinds of things. I have participated in research, so I actually know more about what I'm seeing. So I did a presentation for people in the digital cinema hierarchy, people who are actually trying to decide about standards. And I came up with an image that was about 23 Foote Lamberts. So 1.5 times instead of twice, 1.5 times.
1.5 times. Okay.
1.5 times. And I started them out watching a movie with the backlight on. I actually have a bias light behind my screen.
Wow! And now we have to quickly just say for people who are listening that when we're talking about backlight now, very often that's the light behind the screen of an LCD TV, but that's not what we're talking about here.
We're talking about a bias light.
Bias light.
We've always advocated having a bias light behind any monitor, whether it's your computer monitor or your TV set at home, because watching in a totally dark room will introduce fatigue from the huge amount of contrast that comes off those displays.
Yep.
And so we're talking about the same thing. And as much as everybody thinks of looking at a movie in a completely dark theater, that works at the level of standard motion picture presentations, the 48 nits or the 14 Foote Lamberts, whatever
right.
system you work in. But what we found from human factors is once you start going above the 16 Foote Lambert level, then the contrast gets to be large enough so that fatigue sets in. And this is being borne out in high dynamic range color correcting that's going on in Hollywood. When they try to do it in a dark room, fatigue factor sets in to a point where some colorists are having to take breaks about every 45 minutes. And when you consider that sometimes we take up to 80 hours to color time a movie, having to take a break every 5 minutes in an 80-hour session, it says something about the need for backlighting, and we really have to have it there.
Yeah. But what's amazing to me is that you actually put a bias light behind your projection screen.
Yes.
At home.
And I did this based on the 1970s research that we had done at Eastman Kodak. Mm-hmm. We found out that anything above 14 or 16 Foote Lamberts, there is an issue with fatigue in watching. And so I automatically knew that when I have a new lamp in the projector, I'm getting 23 to 25 Foote Lamberts off the screen. And I knew I had to have a bias light. It was just automatic. From all the work that we had done, I knew I had to have a bias light behind it. Mm-hmm. Well, in bringing people from the technical people from the industry who look at images all the time, their first reaction is, yeah, we've been to a lot of movies at the 100 nit level that Dolby theaters are currently running for HDR. Mm-hmm. And they said, yeah, we haven't noticed any issue with the brightness. And I'm looking at them, really? And so
I have to say I'm among them. I've gone to a lot of Dolby Cinema presentations and I haven't noticed particularly a lot of fatigue, but the rest of your story here, I think, is going to make me think that.
And I have to say that I recognize that if you're not tuned to something, if you're not tuned to what a good picture looks like, you don't know whether the TV set is good or not. And so you have to know what good is before you'll recognize, oh, gee, there is something wrong. And so since I've been consciously living with bias lighting since the 1970s, I'm a little more aware of it than I think most people are. So anyway, in doing this experiment, I brought these technical people in and they've already told me that they see no problem watching a really bright movie, 100 nits, and watching it for a couple of hours. So to help them understand my point of view, I started them out watching a movie that was about 23 foot Lamberts, not anywhere near the 100 nit level.
Right.
And I started with the bias light on and got about 15 minutes into the movie and I shut it off. And then I just waited. About 15 minutes later, they asked me to turn the light back on.
Oh, man. And
that's all it took.
That's all it took.
Without my having shown them what it was like to watch that image with the bias light on, they didn't get why the bias light is needed. When I shut it off, it took about 15 minutes for them to realize, oh my gosh, this is more difficult to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Please turn that light back on.
Wow. Well, and Dolby Cinema's IMAX is right around 22, 23 foot Lamberts. And Dolby Cinemas are at the 31-foot Lambert range.
Yeah.
So that would indicate, according to your research and your experience, that you might want to put a bias light on. Now, there are a couple of questions I have about that right away. One is virtually all, I think, all commercial cinema movie screens are perforated, right? Because they have speakers behind them, and they need to be acoustically transparent. So if you put a bias light back there, what's that going to do to the image in terms of that? Because you're going to be able to see the speakers behind the screen.
I actually think that it's going to have to be a globe. That there is absolutely no reason to light the area behind the screen that you can't see. What the bias lighting behind the screen does is provide light on the periphery around the edge of the screen. So what I think is going to have to happen is you're going to be lighting the entire edge all the way around the screen and that the light is going to be a halo glow. It's going to give the screen a bit of a halo. The level of that light isn't going to be very high. In our original specifications, the level of that light could be no more than 10% of the peak white on the display. I'm emphasizing no more or a maximum of because so many people took that 10% number and said, oh, it has to be 10%. I said, no. Actually, the document says no more than 10%.
It could be less, in other words.
Yeah. Well, the reality is most colorists like something in the order of 5%. And so, but what we determined is that anything above 10% was objectionable and that 10% was the absolute maximum that you could go in providing a bias light. And so the level of that light isn't going to be very high, but I believe that it will provide the irises in your eyes with a bias, that's why it's called a bias light, so that you know, as the irises open and close, with a bias light, there won't be as much activity in the irises as there would be if there is no bias light.
And that activity is what causes the sense of
the fatigue factor.
Fatigue, yeah.
Yeah, that's where the fatigue factor comes from. Mm-hmm. Because it's a strain. Excuse me. It's a strain to have to deal with, you know, having to close your irises down and that sort of thing, going from a very dark scene to a very light scene. And even at 16-foot Lamberts, I'm confident that everybody has experienced a very dark scene transition to a very light scene and have at least been jolted by the difference. And, of course, in high dynamic range, they're going to use that difference. I mean, if they use it in volume, in audio volume, where, you know, it's a very quiet scene and suddenly crash, bang, there's something happened. If you weren't awake before, you're going to be awake now. I actually think that transitions in light are going to be used as surprise elements in addition to transitions in audio. Not looking forward to that, but
well, and bias lighting may mitigate the painful part of that anyway.
Yes.
But that brings up the other question, which is high dynamic range. And as far as I know, in order to really experience the full dynamic range of high dynamic range, you really can't have any light on in the theater. Because if you do, then you're not able to perceive the entire range. So wouldn't bias lighting kind of be contraindicated for high dynamic range?
Well, one of the reasons that the bias light can't be any more than 10% is because it affects your ability to see into the black.
Right.
So if the reality of what you're talking about comes from light getting into the picture, ambient light in the room getting into the picture and actually reducing the contrast ratio. So among the things that would be critical to making this work is the light would have to be behind the screen and in such a way that it's not going to come forward and somehow get into the screen and hurt the contrast of the screen. So the people who implement it are going to have to be very careful about how they do that so that we don't in any way shortchange the contrast that is coming off the screen. And, of course, as you know, even things like exit lights or aisle lights or even the wrong color of seating or even people wearing highly reflective clothing can actually destroy the contrast that's in the room. And I've actually been in theaters where they've had red seating and, you know, people in the first four or five rows, there are no people in the first four or five rows, and the light coming off the screen hitting the red seats bounces back up into the screen, and there's a red bias to the picture caused by the seats. I've seen that.
Wow.
I can name theaters, but I'm not going to.
Let's not do that.
I can name theaters that have done that. But a part of CinemaCon is there was an obvious recognition that this can be a problem. And that where you're going for high contrast, the seats have got to be black.
Wow.
Or dark blue.
Something neutral, something. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Something, of course, they have to be diffusive so that light isn't reflected directly back, but they have to be a really dark color, preferably black. And, of course, the material is diffusive by its very nature, but it definitely needs to be diffusive.
But what about the legal implications? I mean, you cannot turn off the exit lights, for example, I think legally, or the little lights along, I guess, the red the ones, hopefully. Light. The aisle lights. Yeah.
Yes. There's certainly big efforts being made to control where they go and where the reflectivity is and how what angle the reflectivity might be if the IL lights are coming down on the carpet that obviously shows up stairs or whatever in the seating so that you don't trip. The angle of the lighting would have to be down so that any bounce would be straight up and wouldn't be coming forward to the screen and contaminating the contrast of the screen, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Now, all of that said, that's a temporary problem that we have now that is going to go away when we get rid of projection and go to video walls for displays. See how conveniently I just...
Oh, man, that was so smooth. love that.
It's a temporary problem.
Very, very good. Because at CinemaCon, you saw some things that augur the future of cinema as not being projection.
Yes. Everybody is familiar with video walls. I mean, advertising outside, inside, whatever. Everybody knows about video walls.
You go to a baseball park or any Absolutely. Sports stadium. You see a gigantic screen. You see them all over Las Vegas, of course.
Yes. Normally,
but those are not. Those aren't exactly what I wouldn't want to watch a movie on those.
Right. Right. And a major part of the reason I don't think you would want to watch a movie on them is because the individual pixels are so large that it's a pixelated display. But talk about being bright. We talk about high dynamic range being 1,000 nits or 2,000 or 4,000 or whatever.
And that's in a home TV environment, not in the commercial cinema.
Well, these video walls can get to those levels where projection can't. Isn't getting to those levels now. Practical projection is not getting to those levels.
And yet probably won't for the foreseeable future, it seems to me.
But the video walls can get there. 1,000 nits or 500 nits is not remotely out of range for things that can be done today. And you obviously know from light levels that come off signs outdoors, whether it's Times Square or Piccadilly Circus or
Vegas.
Las Vegas. That was one I was trying to think. the biggest example of all.
Las Vegas.
They can reach light levels that are just beyond being able to watch in any kind of a darkened theater. You couldn't watch them because they're so bright.
Right.
So we know the video wall concept can reach whatever practical light level somebody might like to achieve in a cinematic experience. Mm-hmm. But the thing about the video wall is when it's off or any single pixel is off is a black area, much like today's television screens, where you can aim lights at them and that light doesn't get reflected back. It just gets absorbed by the display. Mm. So we could actually seriously increase the lighting in the theater and not compromise the contrast of the picture. So that we could even be doing stronger things in aisle lighting and
exit signs light, and so on. Bias lighting. You'd really need a bias light for a screen like that.
Right. Oh, you'd absolutely. of course, it's my contention you actually needed it 100 nits. But,
right. I understand.
And I think as you go brighter and brighter, which is part of the reason I did the demonstration for people involved with the digital cinema, is because even at a brightness level that's halfway in between normal and Dolby's version of HDR, I can show them that the bias light behind the screen really helps their viewing experience, that it's a much more comfortable viewing experience with that bias light on.
Right. And then if you go to a video wall that's going to give you 500 or 1,000 nits.
Yes. And the bias light is absolutely going to be necessary.
By the way, I should mention real quick that this video wall that we're talking about, the little LEDs that form the pixels in Vegas or at a football stadium or whatever, they're gigantic, relatively speaking. And if you get anywhere near them, you can really see them. But what we're talking about here, these cinema video walls, and there were a couple there at CinemaCon, the LED pixels, there's a little red LED, a little blue LED, a little green LED, are super tiny, really tiny.
They're talking about something like 0.7 millimeters in pixel size. It's really small. And that's actually what's making this technology possible for high quality images. Certainly, as an example, the displays that Sony has shown openly and publicly, you can get much closer than the 1.5 picture heights that is normally suggested for 2160p image. You can get much closer and not in any way be bothered by the size of the pixel. It still looks pretty continuous.
Absolutely. That, by the way, is the Sony Cletus Crystal LED integrated system. And we have a picture of it, actually, that I took at CES called Sony Cletus. And there, not yet. Nope, that's not it. There it is. There it was. What? There it is.
Yes.
You know, that's a video wall. And I have to say, it was like 32 feet wide. And I walked, they allowed me up on the stage and I walked right up to it. And I had to like almost get my nose on the screen before I could actually see the pixels.
And that's my point, that the quality of this has gotten so good that the video wall now, in my opinion, has the potential of being the very best imaging device that is practical to implement. I still believe the laser scan might be better, but the difficulties of actually scanning lasers, and this is completely different from laser lighting up a DMD chip or something like that, but direct laser scan is still going to be a very difficult style of imaging to do. But short of that, I believe this video wall is the most practical high quality display device that is going to come our way. And so I'm seriously enthusiastic about this technology. It has the colorimetry. It has the dynamic range. It doesn't have any of the average picture level issues that accompany LCD or OLED displays. In other words, you can have the whole image be bright, or you can have small sections of the image be the same brightness. And in LCD or OLED technologies, oftentimes when a large portion of the image is bright, that actual absolute level is much lower than when a small percentage of the image is lit up. The small percentage will be, in absolute level, will be maybe 3 or 4 times the amount of light that you can get out of the entire display. These LED, direct LED displays, at least from what I've seen up to this point, don't have nearly that issue. So they would make a much more ideal display device. The colorimetry can be anything that I believe is going to be practical for theatrical presentations. And I'm certain you've seen these signs. The reds can be really bright, saturated red, certainly far better than anything you would get out of a normal display. And then the greens can be much more saturated. So the colorimetry is good. Interesting to me is the technology itself is a 14-bit technology, meaning that it can reproduce a 14-bit grayscale.
Wow. Which at the moment, we should make sure that everybody understands that standard dynamic range, Blu-ray, broadcast TV, all that stuff, is 8 bits.
That's correct.
And the high dynamic range that you get at home is 10 bits.
It's 10 bits from the HDR system. The Dolby system, the Dolby Vision system can deliver 12 bits.
Correct. So, and in fact, it works in 12 bits internally, and right. It could deliver 12 bits, but for the home these days, it's 10. Now, in the commercial cinema, Dolby Vision may very well be 12 bit.
It is 12 bits.
Okay,
It is 12 bits.
But this is even more. This is 14 bits. And you might say, what's a couple of bits between friends? But it's a significant improvement in the smoothness of the grayscale from black to white.
And that becomes important as the image gets brighter, because it's much more gradations or contouring in pictures is mm-hmm. much more easy to spot when there is a larger brightness difference in the images. So as you get to brighter images, you actually need more bit depth to get a smooth grayscale, so that the contouring that might be occurring in this gradation behind me would appear to be perfectly smooth. If that was a bright picture, you would see the gradations in the picture in the gray behind me. So
as bands.
As bands, yes. Contouring bands, mm-hmm. whatever terminology we'd like to use to describe them. But right. The bit depth is absolutely critical as you get brighter and brighter in images. So 14 bits gets us beyond the point where most people believe that at any light levels that they would be dealing with, there wouldn't be any contouring at 14 bits. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so that makes it, call it future-proof, whatever word you want to use. It basically says that we can do a lot with this technology that is going to be far more difficult. Just taking an example, Dolby Vision as an example, can be a 12-bit system, but there aren't 12-bit displays out there that can deal with it.
Other than the Dolby Vision projectors themselves in the commercial cinema.
Right. But
there are no such thing as 12-bit displays.
Yes. As far as you can actually get that in 3-chip projectors. But as far as the OLED and LCD displays, they're not doing it. And right. Here's a technology that does do it, which is part of what's so encouraging to me in its future as an imaging device. Mm-hmm. And I actually believe that over time, we're going to see this in people's homes. It is kind of interesting how it's being touted now for the theaters as being able to get ahead of anything anybody could have at home.
Mm-hmm. Which gets back to our original point of how do you attract people to come to the theater?
Right. And the video walls are definitely one of the things that are being touted. Now, I saw it for the first time at a quality level that I appreciated it at Infocom. Maybe it was NAB last year, and then I saw it again at Infocom. I saw it twice in Las Vegas. So I think I might have seen it first time at NAB and then a second time at Infocom, where mm-hmm. I was extremely pleased with what I was seeing. Is this really does have a future. And I, at the time, said I understood what the cost was and all that sort of stuff. And at the time, I said, well, it's going to be 5 years. And in 5 years, you're going to see this in cinemas. Well, in their press release, I believe that Samsung announced that they're going for an aggressive version of their display, and they're going to actually try to get their displays in theaters, at least some theaters, before the end of this year. And wow,
that'd be something.
Faster.
Yeah,
that's happening a lot faster than even I had imagined. Now, granted, and I'm guessing here that it's going to be a subsidized entry into the theater. In other words, the theater owner is not mm-hmm. going to pay the full price of getting
much as the conversion to digital cinema was heavily subsidized.
Yes. So even Barco Escape is subsidized, and you know mm-hmm. all almost anything that comes along that's more expensive than what the theater owners are used to doing, initially getting it in, it needs to be subsidized until people recognize, oh yeah, that's attractive. And there were discussions at CinemaCon of the upcharges. In other words, sometimes the bargain that struck between the provider of the display is that they will take the entire ticket price of, you know, the normal ticket price. And then the theater owner will charge an extra $2 or $3 for the technology and collect and keep that $2 or $3 for themselves. Mm. And the example that was given in Dubai, they're doubling the price because the theater owner still wanted to get the price of the ticket. Of course, they still have to share that with the motion picture distributor. Right. So they wanted to get the full price, so they just doubled the price in newer technologies, in stuff that was in Dubai. And the discussion that was had during the show was that there aren't a lot of places in the world that can get away with doubling the price.
Yeah, Dubai might be one of them. Well, this brings up a question from I Am Special, which is, what would be the price to replace the cinema screen? And as you say, it would probably be subsidized by Samsung or Sony, probably, because they would be providing it. But it would still, you know, cost something. And then somebody else here, I can't see at the moment, was asking about longevity and maintenance, which would be different for a cinema screen such as this.
Taking each one at a time, this was a year ago, when I approached one of the companies that was doing a video wall display, and come to think, I'm going to stand corrected, it was Infocom, because what Sony showed at NAB last year was a video wall from another manufacturer. They didn't show their own. So I stand corrected. Now that I think about it, I stand corrected on it. That Sony had a video wall at NAB, but it wasn't theirs. It was another manufacturer's. Anyway, right. In talking to manufacturers of panels and what it would take to get that kind of resolution, they were saying, you know, the 38-foot widescreen that you talked about, they were saying it would be someplace between $2 and $4 million. Mm. And considering that a projector goes for $150,000,
mm-hmm. And that's a digital cinema projector we're talking
right.
about.
Yes. There is a slight disparity in between them. And so even if it's the low end $2 million, it's still a disparity where it would appear as if it has to be subsidized. In order to get it in, it has to be subsidized. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that once you gain an audience appreciation and demonstrate that people will be willing to pay more for it, and when we say pay more, as far as I'm concerned, it's paying more than you would pay to see a movie with the best of current laser digital cinema projectors.
Which already cost a few bucks more per ticket than a conventional, quote-unquote, conventional lamp-based projection system.
And I'm without quoting actual numbers, I'm actually trying to emphasize that theaters now with laser projectors are already getting a little bit more for their tickets than the, as you point out, the lamp-based projection. And I expect that when a video wall came in, especially with the fact that it could be promoted with high dynamic range capability, I would expect it to be more expensive. I don't know the numbers, and specifically in answer to the questions being asked, I don't know how much more, but it's pretty obvious that it's going to cost more. Mm. And they're going to have to augment. It's not going to be just the video wall that will cost more. They're going to have to augment the experience.
Yep. In several ways. Yeah.
Well, let me, seating, whatever.
Yeah, the seating and the audio as well. I want to talk about the audio in just a second. Yes. But first, I want to mention that you did see the Samsung example at yes. CinemaCon this year. And we have a picture of that. Actually, we have two. Let's just take a look at the first one called the Cinema Screen. So this was provided by Samsung, this photo.
Yes.
And it's a, you know, it's a regular commercial cinema, and that screen there is not being projected upon. It is emitting light by itself with a bunch of tiny LEDs directly making the picture.
Yes.
And like the Sony Cletus, it seems to me, this was in the press release too, but it wasn't described really carefully, that it's a tiled approach. And there's a graphic yes, we have here about the tile that shows you a picture of the tile, one of the tiles that gets sort of put together like Legos, if you will. If we can find that one, called Samsung Cinema Screen Tile, I think it's called. There it is.
Yes. And Sony is taking the same approach.
Same approach.
Yes. The Sony. In fact, all video walls, all video
virtually
walls
all.
I know about are tiled. And so there are individual modules. Concern has been expressed about these individual modules. And certainly both Samsung and Sony have talked about replacement of individual tiles and showing that it's not a big time-consuming effort, that if something goes wrong within a tile where the entire tile has to be replaced, it is a minor time-consuming function. I'm not confident that they want to advertise how much time it takes to get the ladder out and
put the ladder up. And
I'm not confident that they want to do that. But
right.
I certainly have the impression that they're talking about under a half an hour for a tile replacement, including recalibration.
Mm. Right, right, exactly.
And what we don't know yet is a lot about how these tiles are going to age. If you read in literature, LEDs do decay in light output, and it's color dependent that one color of LED will decay faster than another color, as an example. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, that can be easily compensated by just readjusting the grayscale. You know, obviously, if there's not quite as much blue today as there was yesterday, you either pull down red and green or move blue up, drive the drive to the blue up to get back to normal. So there certainly will be elaborate calibration procedures to make sure that each one of the tiles exactly matches the ones that are adjacent to it in every right. direction.
Right.
Now, uniformity issues, both companies were gracious enough to provide a flat field as part of their demonstration.
Very nice.
I was actually pleased in both situations how, I'm going to say invisible. It wasn't totally invisible, but how little you could actually see of the tiles. It could be the uniformity, especially across the border of the tiles, was quite acceptable. And that actually means that the LEDs are right out to the very edge of the tile. And you match vertically and horizontally, tiles are matched up so that there is an exact relationship between the LEDs from one tile above and below and two tiles on left and right, so that the tiles are an exact match and you just don't see any border in the picture.
Sure didn't on the Cletus. I sure didn't at all. I was amazed, in fact,
I'm going to tell you that I was pleased with what I saw in both displays. Mm-hmm. So for the time being, we're going to leave it at that.
All right.
I was pleased with what I saw.
Now, one last question. One last question is having to do with sound. Now, I know that the Samsung demo was in a real theater. Yes. And I know that you're also under some embargo, some non-disclosure. You can't really talk a lot of detail about this, but I've had a number of questions. I've wrote about the Sony or the Samsung cinema screen on AVS. And one of the first questions in the comments was, well, is it acoustically transparent? How are you going to get speakers behind that screen?
Of course, it's not.
The answer is it's not. Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing is, people who are working with these cinema screens, and these include the audio company that Samsung recently bought. I think it's called Harman International.
Oh, yeah, some little company over there in Northridge. Yeah.
One of the major companies in theatrical sound. Mm-hmm. So I'm pointing that out for obvious reasons. But anyway, there have certainly been discussions of being able to bounce sound off the wall and being able to really localize the sound as it's hitting the wall. So as it bounces off the wall, it bounces off a really local area. The numbers that I have been hearing is being able to set up at least 6 regions in the wall so that you could have 3 high and 3 low as an example. And that pretty much matches configurations I've heard discussed for anything that goes on behind the screen. So there's it would seem possible that sound could be bounced off the screen. Now, I believe this is going to require an architectural change in the way theaters are built, because obviously if you're going to be bouncing sound off the wall, it's going to have to come from out in the direction of the audience from the screen.
Right. And so you're going to have speakers out in the audience but pointed at the screen and being as directional as possible.
Yes. And I, at this point, have no concept of how far out they have to be in order to bounce. And I have no idea what would have to be created in, I'm going to call it the stage, the base of the screen, and what would have to be created in the rafters. I have no idea now what would have to be created there in order to do these things. Now, among the discussion points that I have heard is that it would only be mid-range that would be bounced off the screen, that a set of tweeters above and below the screen would be placed so that high-frequency content would be coming from behind or above and below.
Above and below, yeah.
It would become, in fact, yes.
And, yeah, UJ in the chat room is asking, could beamforming be used here? We've talked about beamforming on the show in the past, and that's a great question.
I don't have any answer to that. I'm not there yet. The discussions I've heard are what I'm telling you about now.
Sure.
Where the level of discussion that I've been privy to up to this point has been strictly bouncing sound off the wall.
And in the mid-range with maybe tweeters above and below the screen, the high-frequency drivers providing that sound directly. Well, as you have said and I have said many times, the future of cinema is kind of interesting, and many possibilities present themselves, it seems to me.
It's certainly going places that are interesting. It was a privilege for me to be able to attend the conference. I believe the attendance reached something like 5,000. Don't remember the number, but interesting for me is the exhibits were at a level that I would expect to see at a conference that was 50,000 or 100,000 people. I mean, the level of exhibition was beyond my imagination for such a small audience. I never would have dreamed that what appeared to me to be maybe even up to $1 million in putting a single exhibit together, when some manufacturers had four or five exhibits within their booth. I can't imagine them having gotten away with anything less than a couple of million for the kind of displays they were showing. And all of this for 5,000 people. Mm. So I actually felt privileged to get into a show where there was such a high degree of technical expertise and technical competence for such a small group of people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you've convinced me to go next year, so I'm looking forward to seeing it myself.
I was thrilled at the level of what I was seeing there. And even the hallway displays, the backlit posters for movies. Yeah, there were backlit posters for movies, but I don't see other manufacturers in any of their displays doing anywhere near the amount of backlighting, transparencies, putting transparencies in front of backlighting. They were far more effective as advertising promotion than anything I'm used to seeing in normal show promotion. Normally they'll just stick a piece of paper up on the wall and it gets lit however it gets lit. But when you backlight it, there is so much more control in what it looks like, plus the fact that it jumps out at you because it's a light source.
Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm.
I'm not used to seeing this level of presentation at the shows I go to, where there's 175,000 people attending. And
at CES, yeah.
They don't go to that much trouble. And
Some of them do. Some booths, some companies go to a lot of trouble at CES, certainly. But what you're saying here makes me think.
It was everybody.
It makes me think that they're spending that kind of money on a relatively small show. There must be that kind of money. They must be able to justify it because of the return on investment. Yeah, okay, they spend $1 million or $2 million at this show, but they're going to get 4 or 5 million or 10 million or whatever in business out of it.
Well, I guess when you're selling projectors at $150,000 a piece, when your product is $150,000 a piece, and mm-hmm. that is probably justification for the type of display that mm-hmm. I was seeing there, and the fact that so many people had $150,000 products that they were trying to sell.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine even the augmented reality that I saw being promoted for the lobby, I can't imagine that isn't expensive, because the displays that were being used, whether it was a backlit poster or it could have been an electronic display, it could have been an LCD display, turned vertically mm-hmm. and have the movie poster on it. That might even be a more convenient way of doing things, but there's a level of expense in even that is quite a bit above what somebody might buy at a consumer electronics show, as an example.
Right, right, right. Well, listen, we've run out of time, but it's been fascinating, and I'm sure glad to have gotten your report from CinemaCon. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for participating in this. This was a lot of fun.
Good, good, good. That's Joe Kane, of course, video guru and the fellow that I open my ears real wide whenever he talks. You can find out much more about what he's doing at his website, videoessentials.com. You can always find me at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and at avsforum. And you can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/HTG or on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/Home Theater Geeks. Next week, I'm going to have three guest geeks on the show. Dave Abrams, calibrator extraordinaire, Mike Heiss and Jeff Tully, both of whom are journalists in our field. They will have just returned from the NAB conference, which Joe's going to as well. to talk about what they saw and heard at NAB. So I do hope you will join me for that. Until then, geek out.